From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There are the obvious differences between a documentary and a feature film, but the director James Marsh says it all comes down to what you do in the editing room. For Marsh, who makes both kinds of films, it's about the way you tell the story. Marsh won an Academy Award for his documentary, Man on Wire, about tightrope walker Philippe Petit. That film premiered at Sundance. His latest project is a feature film. It is also at Sundance this year. It's a tense thriller set in the backdrop of the conflict in Northern Ireland in the 90s. The actor Clive Owen is in the film. He said he wanted to work with Marsh because documentary makers are not interested in anything phony. He says they spend their lives trying to capture the essence of something real. Today in the program, James Marsh will join us to talk about his film. It's called Shadow Dancer, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. This year's Sundance Film Festival is the third appearance for the filmmaker James Marsh. His film Man on Wire, about the eccentric tightrope walker Philippe Petit, was the talk of the festival in 2008. Went on to win an Academy Award. His film Project Nim, about a chimp taught to behave like a human, earned honors and captured everyone's attention at last year's festival. But those were documentaries. His latest film is a narrative feature. It's an adaptation of Tom Bradby's novel Shadow Dancer. The film is set in the midst of the political unrest in Northern Ireland in the early 90s. It's the story of Colette McVeigh, played by Andrea Riseborough. She's a single mother from Belfast who's been arrested for her involvement in a London bombing attempt. A British security officer, played by the actor Clive Owen, makes her an offer. Choose to become an informant on her family, who's heavily involved in the IRA, or go to prison and leave her young son. Owen's character's named Mac, and he reminds Colette, who reluctantly takes the deal, just how high the stakes are. But of course, she knows.
He'll kill me.
They'll never know.
They will.
I'll be there, day and night, watching.
Have you done this before?
Yes.
Are any of them still alive?
Yes, all of them.
Tell you don't need them anymore.
We do this together. But I need to hear you say it. You have to be sure.
Sure.
Today in the program, we continue our coverage of the Sundance Film Festival. We're broadcasting from the Christian Center in Park City, talking with director James Marsh about his latest film. Shadow Dancer premiered here at the festival, and we'll give you more information on screening times for the film as we go. And James Marsh, welcome. Thank you very much.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
I wanted to begin, before we talk about the particulars of the film, just about your beginnings making film. Is it true your father banned you from seeing films when you were young?
Yes, I mean, it was... my father became a born-again Christian as I was growing up, and this made a big change in our sort of domestic situation, yeah. And so we weren't allowed to watch television from that point onwards, and nor were we allowed to go and see films. We weren't great filmgoers already, yeah. Which, of course, creates an interest in what's forbidden.
Yes.
And all Christians should know that in the Christian Center. forbidden fruit is always sweeter.
Right.
And I guess, you know, there's something about the imaginative life you can have in a cinema as a young person that I found irresistible. I love the whole sensation of, you know, actually absconding from school in the lunch hour and going to a cinema and playing hooky and, you know, the cinema goes dark and then you're in this dream world, yeah, as it were. And that has a sort of powerful impact on you as you're growing up and on your imagination. And because it was also this sort of furtive undertaking, and I would seek out, you know, the most inappropriate material to watch as an adolescent,
right,
of course. So that sort of, so you begin to respond to the kind of, I guess, the erotic power, if you like, of, yeah, of the visual image. And that then gradually, you know, you begin to think, well, maybe I can do that.
So it was the image that captured you at first, or was it the story? Or I guess you can't disconnect.
I think it's imagery. It's, huh, imagery of taboo imagery. I liked horror movies.
Wow.
Most teenage boys seem to, it would seem, and Hollywood now organizes this whole kind of culture around that principle. So I liked seeing things that were shocking and transgressive. almost for their own sake.
Yeah.
And occasionally you'd see something really great just by accident. I remember seeing the film Mean Streets quite a few years after it was released. It was re-released. And I saw that film, the Scorsese movie, and there was something else going on in that movie. There was a David Cronenberg film I saw called Rabid that had the same effect on me. So occasionally you'd knock into something really kind of amazing in this quest for nudity and violence.
Right.
That I was doing as a teenage boy.
So this idea of taboo, I'm thinking of... I just wonder how that... If that is a factor in some of the decisions you make about the film. I'm thinking of The King, for example, which was incredibly controversial and
yes, it was.
Really taboo.
And was obviously born out of some of these childhood memories. It was a film, as you know, it was about a born-again Christian minister whose sort of long-abandoned son shows up and creates havoc in his family and destroys his family, essentially. And there were people in America that definitely didn't like that film when it was released. And some people really did like it. That was the first film I directed that came out. It was a buried autobiography, essentially. It was set in Texas. It wasn't set where I grew up. But certainly many of the ideas and the characters were familiar to me from growing up in a Christian household.
But the idea of repression and incest, I mean, you know, basic ideas of taboo, that was a... Is it appealing? I was going to say, was that appealing? Is that a proper word?
I think it's dramatically interesting to go to places like that. And if you're trying to find some kind of truth in that, which as opposed to it just being a sensational, you know, kind of stroke of superficial drama, then I think there's nothing that you can't do in an artistic or creative venture. There's nothing that should be taboo, in my view. And in that case, that was born out of, you know, personal experience to some extent.
Yeah. So... At what point did you decide that you wanted to be a filmmaker? Was that something that you just always...
I mean, I think secretly I was nurturing this desire from the moment I started responding to films and storytelling in movies. But it took me a while to have any kind of confidence that I could do this. Hmm. And I went to university and I met some people there that were interested in film and began to think that I could potentially, you know, try and pursue this career. And in the UK, we don't have a big feature film industry. We have a big... documentary culture.
Yeah.
And we have the BBC and we have Channel 4 and there's a, you know, a very respectable culture of high quality documentary films, which is still true. And so getting into television was probably the path of least resistance as a director. And so I managed to get an attachment to work at a TV station as a kind of researcher and then work my way up to become a director at the BBC.
Yeah.
In the early 90s.
So the intent was, though, I'll do these documentaries for now or I'll do television for now, but you figured that you were headed towards...
Secretly, I didn't tell people this, because you'd kind of look rather foolish, particularly in England. You know, it wasn't, you know, as I said, you know, fiction filmmaking is... There's lots of good, very good TV drama, actually. I should point that out, too.
That's true.
So it's a kind of fantasy that you kind of grope towards to be able to direct, as I've just done, you know, a film with great... well-known actors and the full train set. But it took a long time to get there, actually.
It seems like that aside from the obvious differences, though, between documentaries and, you know, fictional features, that you really don't make that much of a distinction between the two in some ways in terms of the craft.
I don't, actually, and I see the objective to be almost identical. You start a project with a blank canvas, a cinema screen, I imagine it that way.
Huh.
And you fill that canvas with imagery that tells the story as well as you can. And if it's a documentary, the means of production are very different from a feature film. A documentary has a quite an elongated production schedule. You shoot over months and you do a little bit and you look at it and go and do some more. But on a feature film, that's concentrated into a sort of 5 or 6 week period and it all happens then. If you screw it up, then you don't get a chance to make good on your mistake. So they're a little more unforgiving. But in a sense, you're right. I don't make the distinction there. I'm fortunate, in a sense, to be able to do both. And I think that my work in documentary films has definitely enriched the two feature films that I've made and vice versa. You begin to understand more about dramatic structure by doing fictional film and writing them, as I did the first film I made.
You know, you do these powerful recreations in some of your documentaries, which made me wonder... If you can storyboard a documentary like you do a feature film, like the visual component...
That's an interesting question, and it's purists would say that you shouldn't and couldn't. But the films I make are very constructed. I feel like I'm an archaeologist, in a sense, kind of digging up material that's been forgotten or half forgotten and trying to find essentially the dramatic story in that material. And within that, there's truth. Mm. But all documentary filmmakers, the moment they make an edit in a film, are changing reality. There's no such thing. And I don't think that there's any prescription in documentary films for how you get to the truth, if that's your objective.
And but you always hear these rules, though. I mean,
indeed, and they feel to me to be irrelevant. I've never even thought about if there's any rules. And if there are rules, I would love to break them. There's nothing nicer than the sound of a rule being snapped. It's a great sound. So in a sense, there are still, to this day, it seems weird that people reproach you for reconstructing parts of a documentary. And so as I was saying, you know, I construct them and I'm looking for dramatic shape in an existing story. So with Project NIMH, you know, there's all kinds of different stories I could have told with that story, but the story I chose to tell was the story of the chimpanzee and the people that knew him. I didn't pursue the scientific theoretical implications of the story particularly, and that could be a failing of the film. My interest was in the emotional and physical drama of that story. And so I do actually lay out on paper a sense of what the film might be, a documentary film, which again feels like heresy. How can you predict what it's going to be like? But, yeah, you know, a lot of the source material I'm working with is from books or from articles. And you have, in a sense, why wouldn't you do that?
Right.
And try and understand dramatic structure. And then, of course, when you interview people and get their testimony, that's the basic raw materials of my film, is people's memories. You need to be very alive to changing the story. And Project NIMH is a very good example of that. I thought I knew what I was going and doing one story, ended up actually bouncing the story back to the humans.
Yeah.
That's what I discovered by talking to people, that the primate drama playing out amongst them was fascinating. And the film became as much about our behavior as it was about the chimpanzees. And I could be more sure about our motivations because I'm human too. And understand, I guess, more about our motivation than I ever could about a chimpanzee. And that was part of the, in a sense, the NIMH's tragedy was that people projected onto him human characteristics he didn't really have and expected him to behave in a certain way and inhibit himself as a chimpanzee. So that's an example of a story that I thought I knew what I was doing going in and I didn't. Mm. With Man on Wire, Philippe had written this brilliant, playful, idiosyncratic memoir of his adventure at the World Trade Center. And that was a great starting point, and I used that and constructed from his book a kind of thriller structure for that documentary, which was, you know, speaking to heist films, and I saw his adventure as he did. It came from him,
yeah,
as a kind of beautiful bank robbery where something is given rather than stolen. I love the subversive inversion of a crime that harms nobody and is a gift to people, and it's an artistic gift and a beautiful gift, yet it's done with a criminal conspiracy to yield that gift, if you like.
So what do you... It's interesting, if you look at... Documentaries are all lumped. All kinds of different ones are lumped into one place. And a lot of the times you hear this idea that they're supposed to be about an issue and they're supposed to be created by a journalist. Like, you don't often, I mean, you hear the term filmmaker, I suppose, but often it's just conceived of as a journalist, maybe a subjective journalist or an objective journalist telling this issue. That's not at all how you see it.
It's not, actually. I'm very glad that people do make films that are about issues that we all need to concern ourselves with and report on the contemporary world. And I think in the last 11 years, American journalism has needed the ballast of filmmakers, documentary filmmakers, exposing, certain, very regrettable developments in the world of America, and that's all, I think, perfectly. I think, you know, it's what should happen, but I think there's many other ways of making a documentary film, and there should be no prescription as to how you make it. And some of those films are actually really boring, to be honest with you. And if you're belaboring some cause, make a good film. That's your first duty. It's not to advocate for something. I think you have to make the film work. And then if you are concerned about something, a cause, an issue, then I think you need to make sure that you take care of your filmmaking as well as just allowing the cause to, in a sense, only convert those that are already there. And that feels again like a self-defeating objective. You're only going to only reaching people who already agree with you. That's not true of many of the films that I think have really poked through and given us a very interesting perspective on the contemporary world. I mean, I'm thinking of Taxi from the Dark Side, which is an Alex Gibney film, like a very necessary film about what went on, you know, in our name in the Middle East. But I think it's very foolish to put yourself in, give yourself restrictions, or indeed that think that only that kind of issue-based filmmaking is valid, and that somehow what I do is you know, is not valid or truthful or indeed cheating somehow.
You've said this, that what interests you about the documentaries that you make is that if they were fictional stories, you would have a hard time believing them.
It certainly would. I mean, that's certainly true of Man on Wire. Who'd believe that?
Right.
And who'd believe? And what was so great about that story was that there were details in Philippe's book. I said, there's no way that could have happened like that. No way. You've got to be exaggerating. You've got to be embellishing. And of course, all the most preposterous and outlandish details all checked out in Philippe's story. Project Nim is another example of a story that you would struggle to believe that it was offered to you as fiction. I saw a film at Sundance called The Imposter, which almost tells you already you're in a world of deceit and things that struggle to believe something. An extraordinarily well-made film about an imposter, which again, you'd never believe that film if it was made as a fictional movie.
James Marsh is with us. He's the director of the film Shadow Dancer. It's part of this year's Sundance Film Festival. There are still two screenings left. You can see it tonight at 9:30 at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. That's in Salt Lake City. Saturday night, it's playing at the Redstone Cinema 7 in Park City. That's at 7 o'clock. You can get details on our website, KUER.org/Radio West. We're broadcasting live from the Christian Center of Park City today, and we need to take a brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We've been broadcasting all this week from Park City, covering some of the films from the Sundance Film Festival. We're taking a break from documentaries today, though. We're talking with James Marsh. You may know him from his documentaries. He did highly acclaimed films Man on Wire and Project Nim. His latest is a narrative feature film called Shadow Dancer. It's a tense, complex thriller set in the 90s during the time of the conflict in Northern Ireland. He's joining us to talk about this particular film, but also his approach to storytelling. We'll give you details about the screenings for Shadow Dancer as we go along. James Marsh, what was your first encounter with the project Shadow Dancer?
I was sent a script as I was finishing a TV film that I was doing called Red Riding. And I almost didn't read it because I knew it was about Northern Ireland and the Troubles. And
as they call it.
As they call it. Yeah. I mean, it's a very interesting euphemism. And I would say this, you know, it's an exhausting conflict that had a big impact on the British Isles, not just in the north of Ireland, but also I grew up partly in London, and it's something that I think we're just, dare I say it, sick of. And it's come to some kind of equilibrium now. So I thought, oh, you know, God, Northern Ireland, you know, is that something I want to dive into? What right do I have? And I almost didn't read the script, but I read the first 10 pages and got caught up in this extraordinary premise. The story is sort of predicated on the idea that a young a single mother goes to London on a mission for the IRA and is caught red-handed and given this impossible bargain. Will she, you know, will she go back and report and snoop and spy on her own family and report to the British intelligence services, or will she stay in jail for 25 years and never see her son grow up, which is a horrible choice to be offered. Yeah. But dramatically very interesting, of course.
That is a good moment to play another clip, if we could. This is that moment where he, Clive Owen, who's playing Mac, the British security officer, makes this offer to Colette. Do you mind if we play that?
No, please do.
Here it is from the film Shadow Dancer.
You agree to watch him and talk to us. You're out of here like nothing ever happened. Back to your ma. Back to your boy. We'll pay you. And one day, if you want it, we'll give you a life far away from this. Nobody dies. Nobody gets hurt. We just talk.
I want to know you.
This isn't who you are, Cullen.
Why the f*** would you know who I am?
I know it bugs the hell out of you that your mum won't get a washing machine fixed. I know you're asking yourself why your boy still wears his bed at night. And I know you were so lonely the night before you came down here that you went home with some guy you don't even like.
I want a lawyer.
You can have all the f***ing lawyers you like, but it's not going to change a thing. We've got you. You're finished. You're done. So is your boy. Look. There's the paperwork to have him taken into care. Hey, you really want a lawyer? You want to go that way? Just don't line for an outside line.
So that was the story it's not the political part at all. I mean, that's the backdrop. That's the context.
Indeed.
For it.
I think, you know, that it's such a complicated conflict, and it would be foolhardy to think you could distill that into a drama of 90 minutes. And what we've done, I think, with this story, and Tom Bradby, who wrote the novel and indeed the screenplay, was a political correspondent in the north of Ireland in the early 90s and reported on that conflict as the peace process began to take hold there. So a lot of what he's writing is from direct personal experience. And my interest in this was very much in the psychology the dramatic possibilities of what you've just heard. What is it like to go and betray your brother, your mother, people you're living with, people you're close to, people you have breakfast with every morning? What would that be like for someone, a young woman like Colette in our story? So that's what got me going on this particular, was the human element, not the politics.
It was so interesting. I read where you had... even though this is not about the political dimensions of that, that you read everything you could get your hands on about Ireland.
Well, I did. I felt I needed to. I read Irish history. I knew quite a bit from just my educational sort of, you know, exposure to history. But I also read a lot about the present conflict, if you like, where that started, how that came into being. And it really came to being with the partition of Ireland in 1921. But I felt I needed to know all this in order to... Just because if someone would ask me, or the cast or the actors would have questions, I needed to be able to tell them and give them this context, even though none of that context is actually in the film. But it feels like you do need to earn your right to tell this story by knowing the bigger picture. And that bigger picture is endlessly complicated. Yeah. And then you realize that you've probably made a good choice by blinkering yourself to what you can understand about this conflict, which is the human element to it and how people behave in these unusual and hateful circumstances.
So what did you do when you first, the first drafts that you saw of the script, or of the book even, did you just pare down, strip away?
Yes, I mean, the book is a much more expansive, and there's much more action in it. Likewise, the first draft of the screenplay that I saw had quite a lot of elaborate action set pieces, and very different in its last act, actually, than the film that you've seen, that the Shadow Dancer that we brought here.
Yeah.
And my job then felt like I needed to boil this right down into something that, firstly, we could afford to shoot, and secondly, that, in a sense, spoke of all the things I'm talking about, this focus on the human drama and the psychology of it. Excuse me. So I worked with Tom for about 6 months, you know, butchering his script, literally. But in a constructive way, butchering being, you've got a carcass and I'm going to make some pork chops out of it.
Right. How did he take to it?
Surprisingly graciously. He's a very gracious man, Tom, generally, very old-fashioned, very courteous man. And it was his first screenplay as well. And he trusted me that I was going somewhere. We didn't always agree on everything. But he trusted me a lot and gave me a license to, even when in production, I changed quite a few things as we were filming. Scenes I would rewrite them, shift them around a bit.
Why? I mean, at a particular moment, just because something occurred? I guess
because what happens when you go into production is you're up against the hard reality of what you're going to do.
Yeah.
Until that point, it's you can speculate that I can have this piece of equipment and this location, and I can light this fire and blow this building up. And when you get to it, you can't. And then you have to rely on other kind of ways of creating tension and drama. And in a Hollywood movie, you have loud bangs and effects that you could, literally, you can set your watch by maybe 20 minutes, you'll have one. And in this story, which has already been called Slow Burning for that reason, I guess, which I take as a compliment.
Good, I was going to say, I wonder what you made of that.
Slow Burning not being boring, Slow Burning being, you know, hopefully the film gathers a certain kind of suspense and weight as it goes. So I didn't have any of those resources to blow things up and shoot people. And so as an example, in the opening of the film, it's a very long, wordless sequence on an underground train where Colette is on this mission. In her bag, we suspect, is some kind of explosive device. We observe her on the London Underground with normal people around her for quite a long time, which I hope is suspenseful.
It is.
Rather that than, you know, people chasing around on motorbikes and screaming police cars, which was in the original screenplay.
Yeah. But it's the same effect, I think, you know, in the sense that you, it's thrilling.
Well, suspense comes from empathy.
Right.
With a character, even if the character is a very unpleasant character. Yeah. You put your audience in the position of that character, even if they're doing, in this case, what appears to be a very horrible thing. And therefore you care about it. I mean, think about Psycho, the movie Psycho, where Norman Bates has just slaughtered Janet Leigh in the shower, and Hitchcock then invests you in his cleanup of that crime, the hideous, horrible crime, and you begin to want him to clean it up better. That's a classic example of, you know, how a good director can make you empathize with a very bad character doing a very bad thing. So Hitchcock is, you know, a great master of these things and someone that I looked at before I made this film.
Wow. Talk about Colette. And I wonder, was she... I mean, she's clearly a central character in the book.
Hmm.
But she's the focus almost, certainly she and Mac, but
she's the protagonist in the old fashioned sense of that word.
And was she always that way for you, do you think?
Yes, I mean, in the original screenplay, there was quite a few different points of view that you'd spend time with other members of the family and see their perspectives. And it's one of the first choices you make as a dramatist is whose points of view do you invest the audience in? Whose perspectives do you show? And in this case, we show hers predominantly, and we also show a little of her brother and little of her principal antagonist in the IRA, played by David Wilmot, a man called Mulville, and indeed Clive Owen's character. But you're right, it's her point of view, and I think, you know, what makes it quite uncomfortable as a thriller, that you're being forced to reckon with her predicament as she is, you know, beat by beat in the story. Every time she's in that house, she's a traitor. Many films do this, and I always kind of like them when someone in every scene is being something that they're not, whether they're a man being a woman, you know, or whatever else it is. In Colette's case, she's a spy in her own house.
What's so, I think, compelling about the character, too, and Mac knows this, which is interesting. He knows, for example, that she went to the funeral of someone who was a target of a murder that she participated in.
He's looking for her weaknesses and using them against him. And her main weakness, of course, is the fact that she's a mother, which in any other dimension would be a strength.
But she also doesn't set the timer on the bomb.
No, here's the thing. It's probably an important characteristic to stress is that she is weary of this like many other people are.
Yeah.
And she's exactly the kind of member of the IRA that's open to dialogue and a peace process, and her brother is not. And you see that in the background of our film. There's that debate somewhat going on. You know, the men of violence are being left behind. People are beginning to talk. And how they're going to respond, and they respond in a sort of habitual way by doing more violence. Colette's not like that. She's disillusioned with all this, and you can see that in her face the moment you kind of clap eyes on her as a woman. And so Mac knows that about her, but more importantly, I guess, for his nefarious objectives, he exploits the best thing about her, which is her mothering instincts.
You know, there's such a stillness in her face. There's weariness and almost constant exhaustion, it seems. And I'm wondering, this seems a silly question, but I guess it's acting, right? But I mean, how do you convey that as a director? I mean...
Well, I don't convey it, thank goodness. Andrea does.
Yeah.
Andrea Riseborough, the actress who plays Colette. But clearly, as a director, you're the first witness to her performance.
Yeah.
And my sort of view of directing actors is to keep out of their way.
Yeah.
And I've cast people very carefully with two criteria. One is that I'm excited by their work, and I want to photograph them and work with them. And secondly, that I need to feel there's a personal connection between us, and that it's about that connection as well as about their talent. And Andrea, you know, I connected with her very easily, and she's an extraordinary actress. She reminds me of a silent movie actress in a way that you can do a close-up and there's so much being revealed in that close-up that she offers discreetly. Yeah. She's not a flamboyant actress. It's not a kind of big showy performance. It's much cleverer than that and much more emotionally attuned to the predicament of the character than lots of hysterics and theatrics. What you see is someone who's under, as you say, constant pressure and is sort of gripped in a vice of anxiety scene by scene and suffers accordingly. And Andrea's quite a physically petite woman and she looks physically fragile, even though she's not. Trust me, she's a fiery and robust character outside of the role. And, you know, that's Andrea's great talent.
Yeah.
And my job is to support that. And create the right circumstances for her and the other actors to do their work. And if it's working, I just keep out of the way.
Right.
And if it isn't working, you step in and try and make it work. But, you know, the casting for me is the most important act of direction, in a way. Something Robert Altman was very keen on, too. It was his great sort of mantra. Once I've cast, that's it. My job is done with the actors.
Yeah.
I'm a little bit more involved with them than that, and I'm sure he was too. But certainly if you cast actors that you like and want to see, you know, doing your film, then your first duty is to allow them to do that. And Andrea is a brilliant and very intelligent actress, and we had a very interesting time doing it, and a very good time doing it. And it wasn't actually, as so often is the case, it wasn't we were doing quite dark material where we're going to suffer and be miserable about it. We had an enjoyable time making the film, and one should. It's a privilege.
Yeah.
And the work is very focused when you're doing it, but it's not like we're all standing around with glum faces being sacred and sincere about this. It's, you know, you need to do it in a lightness of spirit and a gentle sort of way as well, particularly with materials like this when it's really quite heavy.
You know, one thing that was striking for me was that the film, there are so many gray tones to it, and then Colette wears this red overcoat.
Yes, indeed. I mean, that's obviously a very conscious choice on our part to, you know, when you go to Dublin, where we shot most of the film, we were there in the summer, you wouldn't have known it. It's a gray, forbidding sky almost every day. The buildings have muted colours, and I really wanted to make sure that our fragile protagonist was just available visually in the colour palette we'd chosen, or was given to us essentially by the locations. And so she does wear this rather striking red overcoat. And I asked my costume designer to look at a Hitchcock film called Marnie, which has very, very powerful colour coding in its costumes. And I said, well, have a look at that. And I think we can do, with our sort of canvas of muted greys and greens, we can have a strong primary colour that will just stand out. And she's always been, we always know where she is with that coat on.
Yeah. Talk about Mac, if you would. It's interesting, Tom Brady has talked about how Mac was younger. And I guess originally he was a more sort of aggressive character when you first approached
him.
Yes,
he was. He was younger and probably sexier, I guess. Not that Clive Owen isn't sexy.
No.
My wife was thrilled when she realized I was working with Clive. And when can I meet him? Right. You know, when can I cuckold you with him?
Right.
You know, he's a very, you know, very strong masculine presence in the film. But Clive is a little older than as the character was as written. And there's something about their relationship that becomes quite interesting for that reason, that he's older. And there's a kind of underlying kind of sexual frisson, but that's all it is in the story. We don't, you know, make the obvious leap into they're going to have an affair and they're going to ride from the sunset together, you know, on his white charger. That's not going to happen, because the film is, you know, a bit more realistic than that.
Yeah.
But Clive came to the production quite late, even though he was the first person I wanted to cast in the role. And once you've cast Clive, you know, you get something that I really wanted, which was this sort of masculine vulnerability and a good man in a bad world. And what's interesting about the character is that what he's doing is very cynical, but actually the world he's in is even more cynical than even he is. And it becomes, the degrees of cynicism become the engine of doom for many of the characters. They're not cynical enough. And so what he's doing with Colette is essentially he begins to understand in the story that there's a bigger picture which he's not privy to, and he's being manipulated by his own side as well.
Yeah.
And that Colette is very vulnerable for that reason. And he begins to have a sort of awakening of conscience, which is a disaster in the job he has, which involves, you know, deceiving people and coercing them to do terrible things. And cheat, and you know, it's all based on deception. And he indeed is also the victim of that and begins to try and act in a good way. And of course, that's always a bad thing in a film like ours.
I want to play another moment from the film. This is Mac by Clive Owen and his superior, played by Gillian Anderson. And he's pleading with her to let him sort of get her off the hook because he's realizing that it's not as he appeared. Do we need to say anything more about
this? No, the context is that Gillian Anderson plays his boss, who's a kind of icy cold, very unemotional woman who, again, it's interesting that she's a woman. That was a change I made in the script. Originally, she was a man.
Wow.
And I felt it would be very interesting to make women very much a part of this story. And there would have been female MI5 officers at that time. And we have, of course, you know, Colette is a woman and her mother's a big part of the story too. And I like that idea very much of making her into a woman. And so she has got a bigger game that's being played above Clive Owen's character, and he doesn't know really what's going on. And in this particular scene, he's beginning to find out.
But Colette McVeigh was your idea, so I'm asking myself why. You know, I spend 8 months reading her in, and you're prepared to burn her on day one. Why? I tell you why I think. I think Mulville was getting close to Barry's tower, and you just wanted some f***ing red meat to throw him. I want to take her out.
That's out of the question.
Look, they'll assume she's one of ours, so she'll still take the heat off whoever it is you're trying to protect.
That's fantasy. Besides, she's only just got started.
Yet she's done what we asked of her.
Come on. A new identity, protection, a house, income for life. What is that? 1 million? Throw into that 8 months' work, setting her up. It's more like 2. You think London's going to buy all that just for one good hit on Conor McVeigh's crew? Forget it.
We made a deal.
I absolutely forbid it.
Kate, she's got a son.
Is this because she has a pretty face, Mac? Because I thought you were a lot smarter than that.
Well,
a low blow there at the end, of course.
Yeah,
so you get the flavour of what's going on from that, that Clive is beginning to kind of, you know, have a protective sense for Colette because he can see that she's really being set up to take a fall for somebody else. I won't say any more than that because
the film
definitely works better if you don't know the story.
Absolutely.
And even by telling that, I don't think anyone will see what will happen at the end, even
Absolutely.
With that little hint that I've given you. But there's, you know, there's some, a couple of very big surprises in store for our characters and I think for our audience. I was at the screening yesterday morning and there's this one particular moment towards the end. I was very curious to see how people were going to respond.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at 500 people in profile and they all, almost at one, leapt out of their seats. And I could see the whites of their eyes with the ambient light of the screen. And it was a great moment for me. It was one of my favourite moments as a director. It was that moment I saw yesterday morning when I'd managed to make the whole cinema yelp. I mean, it probably speaks back to my horror, my days of horror cinema as a teenager, that I'd managed to do something like that. I'd made everyone jump.
James Marsh is with us. He's the director of the film Shadow Dancer. It's part of this year's Sundance Film Festival. There are 2 screenings left. You can see it tonight at 9:30 at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in Salt Lake, or Saturday night it's going to play at the Redstone Cinema 7 in Park City. That's at 7 o'clock. Go to our website for the details, KUER.org/Radio West. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the filmmaker James Marsh about his latest. It's a feature film called Shadow Dancer. It's set in the 90s during the time of the conflict in Northern Ireland. It's here, part of the Sundance Film Festival. We're broadcasting from the Christian Center in Park City today, and James Marsh is joining us. Look, I wanted to ask you about, you know, the character played by Brigitte Brennan, the mother, such an interesting character in many ways because we don't really hear her say much. I mean, she's almost this constant presence in some ways, but she doesn't say anything, but it seems like such an important... I mean, it's, of course it's an important role, but she's doing a lot with a very little, I
suppose. Indeed, she certainly is, and she's very watchful in the film, and she's clocking everything, and you can see that. She's not saying much. She's not intervening in what's going on, and she's passively accepting her children, you know, undertaking criminal terrorist activities, essentially. And she, I think there's a sense that there is a generational thing in the Irish conflict. It is sort of passed on from generation to generation, it would seem. And she is, you get the sense that she is sick to death of the whole thing and wants out somehow and can't find a way out. It's a very, very interesting performance. And, you know, when you see the film, remember this, what I'm saying now, you know, pay attention to what she's doing because it has a big payoff at the end of the story. But she's watchful and she's suffering as well. You can really sense, and Breege, the actress, really gives you that sense of someone who is just exhausted by all the things they've had to put up with over many years. And she's a matriarch. Her husband isn't around anymore. You get the sense that he may have been killed in the conflict. And there she is watching her sons going out on these missions and accepting it passively, but you do sense her weariness about all this. And then her daughter comes back from London, and again, there's very interesting underlying tensions between them. She knows what's going on, it would seem. So all in all, it's a fascinating role, and Breege played it, I think, exquisitely well.
Well, Breege is from West Belfast.
She is indeed. She's from a Republican family in West Belfast, which is very good for us to have someone of that age who'd been through a lot of the conflict, its various stages from the 70s through to the 90s. Mm. It started off as a civil rights movement. As so often in these kind of conflicts, it starts off as a peaceful protest and there's an overreaction to it and then it becomes violent. You see it happening in the Middle East. You know, it's on a different kind of scale. She's a very important kind of glue for the story, I think.
You've said this about documentary films at some point. You said that you don't believe in spoon-feeding morals in documentary films. And I wonder, do you think of it in a similar way?
Oh, I hope so. I think so. I mean, I resist them as an audience member.
Yeah.
And what I'd like to do is to allow people to complete a film for themselves and not to tie everything up in a neat little bow. Oh, here's the moral of this particular story. And the morals that Hollywood offer are very limited morals. And they're phony. And life isn't like that. And there's some reassurance, perhaps. When you've seen them about 25 times, they're just empty, fatuous, you know, kind of crude, this is good and this is bad. And there's a sort of spectrum of morality that's much more interesting than that this film, I think, you know, embraces. There's no such thing as something being only good and only bad, and that's true of characters too. I don't find films with those kind of fatuous conclusions to be very edifying for me. Certainly not morally so.
Yeah.
Or even reassuring. I find the opposite. I find the fact that we're given these sort of cheap, silly morals in Hollywood movies. And I can say that because I've seen enough of them to have an opinion about it. So in a sense, you know, I resist it. And the last thing I do is, you know, literally open your mouth and stick something in it. I'd much rather that a film like Project Nim, which has a very complex set of moral issues in them, I don't want to discuss them. I want you to think about them if you want to. I want to tell you a story first and foremost. And any ideas in that story hopefully are generated by the act of telling that story and not by discussion of it. I'm not Michael Moore. I don't get you by the lapels and you know, which I think there's a real value in that kind of filmmaking.
Sure.
I really do.
But it's just not for you.
It's not for me. I wouldn't be comfortable doing that. Nor am I comfortable campaigning for anything. I don't feel strongly about things. I'm not sure that film is the right medium for me personally to express my personal opinions. I'm interested in storytelling and what ideas you can find in a story that should emerge from that very act of telling that story.
So where do you think you're headed artistically these days? I mean, are you content to sort of going back and forth,
well,
documentaries?
I'm not content in anything. I want to you know, keep plunging into new abysses that I'm not quite sure what's going to happen when I plunge into them. In other words, I don't want to repeat myself. Yeah. And actually doing documentaries and feature films is a good way of changing, you know, rhythm each time you do one or other of those kind of genres. And I think, you know, every film I wanted to be very different stylistically and thematically and narratively. So I'm not looking to kind of...
So you don't want there to be a James Marsh style? Oh, that's...
I wouldn't want it to be a part of that discussion, no. I like to actually... I would rather remain anonymous. I don't want people to recognize me or know anything about my personal stuff. It's more... Or even, you know, indeed be able to categorize what I do as a filmmaker, because I'm just sort of a curious person making films about things that I find interesting. What a privilege I have. I mean, it's amazing, really. And in documentaries, that's true, and in features, that's true. So each time I make a film, I think that's that. I want to move on to something completely different and not know what it is. And then that world, you know, for example, doing Man on Wire, what a great world to step into, the world of, you know, wire walking and Philippe's character and that kind of performance art that he does. So, you know, I would say that what I want to do is just do something completely different next. I'm not sure what it is yet, but it'll have to be different. I don't want to make another spy thriller, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. Man on Wire, for example, clearly it was Philippe's perspective, but it was such a New York film in some ways.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a New York film, you know, by its era
and
its location. You know, the buildings are there, of course. But I think that, you know, I went to New York for the first time in the late 80s, as just finishing as a university, and that kind of excitement I had that anything was possible here, even though I have no money, everything is possible in this city, and it just bowled me over. And that film was a homage to my own reaction to New York and its endless possibilities. That as a young man, nothing is impossible here.
Yeah.
And that was the mantra that Philippe took to. You know, obviously, I didn't do anything as amazing as that. but it was definitely that. It was a love letter to New York. And I was leaving. I'd lived in New York for 14 years by the time I got to make Man on Wire. And I was leaving New York. I was going back to Europe with my children. And so I was very conscious of that, making that film. It was very much a love letter to the New York that I'd first discovered and adored.
But it made me wonder, that what was the influence, do you think, of America, living here for so many years, on the work that you did? Did it?
Oh, well, it was huge. I mean, I came to America as a documentary filmmaker making films for the BBC and with a sort of wide-eyed innocence about American life and American culture. And then through that, I ended up moving to New York and wanting to live in New York and to be a part of that city. So I moved there in 1994. And then began to make even more films about America and the American experience. My feature film, The King, was very much rooted in an American, even though it was to some extent biographical. So America gave me great material, and Man on Wire was the culmination of that. It was a great New York film, involved Europeans. You know, Philippe is very French.
Very.
And I was leaving New York, and in fact, I left New York the week that the film opened in New York, and it played in New York for 7 months, that movie.
Wow.
And when I came back in February of 2009, it was still playing in the same cinema. And it had a record at this point. The films don't do that anymore. And that film, so New York embraced that film.
No, certainly not
film.
Documentary films either.
No. So it survived, you know, for months and months and months in the cinema. And so I felt that New York had responded to it very well. And I was delighted with that.
So I won't ask you to be specific about an idea, but is there something documentary-wise that you're working through?
There has been a project I've been working on for 2.5 years, which feels like it's almost impossible to make, and therefore I am pursuing it very foolishly. It's based on a dream diary. This sounds really crazy. Anyway, I came upon an archive of dream diaries in a facility in California, part of the University of California at Santa Cruz, and they do research into dreams and sleep. And the dream diary I found was a man who'd recorded only dreams which involved the woman he was in love with throughout his life. So he'd just written down, so he'd filtered all his dreams. It wasn't like a conventional dream diary where you write down your dreams and weird stuff happened and I'm gonna write it down. He just wrote the dreams down that featured this one woman. And so it becomes a love story. The dreams represent, in their fragments, the story of his time with the woman he was in love with and end up marrying, having children with. And there are dreams that reflect the whole arc of this love story. And she dies young and in a very sad and tragic way. And there are dreams that then speak of that and speak of his grieving. And so this project is a kind of dramatization of this dream diary as a love story, taking the individual dreams. And I made a script that starts with him falling in love with her and being infatuated with her. Then there's some sexual episodes. It's their dreams. That happens. There are dreams in about them living together and having children. Then there are dreams about them separating and him having an affair. And then there are dreams about them reconciling. And there are dreams about them, about her dying and death. And then there are dreams about his grieving. So whether this can be made is another matter. But it has an emotional arc to it, even though the dreams, of course, are dreams. They're weird, crazy, strange, but within them is an emotional content that I think, if organized correctly, could be quite an unusual film. Pretty hard to fund, though.
Yeah. You know if it's going to work?
I will never know until I make it, right. And it may not work then. You know, it may be absolutely unwatchable. And I'm very aware of that, you know, that observation. Other people's dreams are boring. And they kind of are, in a way. But if organized correctly into a narrative, maybe they're not. And so I've never seen anything quite like this, and I'm determined to make it. Though it's unfortunately quite an expensive film because it involves elaborate fantasy dream sequences from start to finish. There's a documentary element to it as well. I've interviewed the man who, I've tracked him down. He's an old Jewish man living in Canada, in Toronto. And I interviewed him and talked to him about his life story. So I've got those raw materials already. And so I can intersect the real love story with the feverish representations of that love story in dreams. Now, this may sound terrible. Maybe your viewers should phone in and tell me whether I should do it or not. Take a poll, a phone poll.
Great.
Should I pursue this or should I give it up?
Well, I vote yes.
Thank you.
James Marsh, the director of Shadow Dancer. It's part of the Sundance Film Festival, of course. Two screenings still left. You can see it tonight at 9:30 at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center or Saturday night at the Redstone Cinema 7 in Park City. That's at 7 o'clock. Go to our website for the details. James Marsh, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Rob Harder and Richard Rothman of the Christian Center of Park City. Thanks also to Geraldine Dreyfus of the Utah Film Center. Our thanks to KUER's Mike Anderson and our engineer, Lewis Downey. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.